Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. Hosted by author, investor, hard money lender, and real estate educator, Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
Hi, thank you for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris, and today our special in-studio guest is Rick Solis. Rick is a real estate investor, a property manager, note buyer, options investor, real estate appraiser, and teacher sometimes. Rick, welcome back to our show.
Thank you.
I think we'll talk a little bit about your favorite subject, rentals.
Rentals.
Property management. Why did you guys decide to, I'm assuming you managed them yourself. Why did you decide to do that?
Well, at one point in my appraisal career, I had four or five employees working for me. And I had payroll taxes, and I had to have a desk for each one, and a chair for each one, and a computer for each one, and a phone for each one. And if any of those things broke, I had to take care of getting that solved. And I just realized that employees was not for me. I don't like doing that. So I could not figure out how to make that work. It's just not how I'm set up. I made more money when my employees were gone. So we managed most of these because we didn't want to hire a property manager, and we also didn't want to hire employees. In hindsight, we would have done a lot better with one employee and probably had a lot more houses and had a lot less headaches, and I'd be a lot less burned out had we picked up an employee.
Just to do the property management side?
Yes.
As opposed to hiring a property management company?
Well, I did put some of my rentals with property managers, and I've always done that, and probably maybe 10 to 20% of our stuff was with property managers, and that's not so bad. It's just they don't do as good of a job, and things do cost more, but you don't have to deal with that property. So where I can get a repair done for 150 bucks, they might be paying 300 bucks, but I don't have to deal with it.
Right.
And
what about the selection of tenants? Were they on par, or they make decisions?
I actually noticed the tenants we got with the property managers were better than the ones we got.
Okay.
Which is surprising, because we would advertise everywhere. We would get maybe 30 calls, show it to 10 people, get five or six applications, and take the very best of the applicant. And still, it was a 50-50 shot on whether we would be evicting that person or it was going to go to a successful conclusion. Maybe not evict. Some just took off. Some left and didn't pay last month's rent. Some destroyed the property. I mean, there was all kinds of levels of that. But half the time, after 2012, it was a crapshoot. Now, before 2012, we were getting people that used to be homeowners. So they'd done a short sell or they lost their house in foreclosure. That was a much better tenant for us, the ones we got 2010 and 11. It just seems in the high desert, once you got 2012, I don't know if somebody sent a memo to everybody, hey, stop paying rent, or if you're a good tenant or you pay bills on time, it's time for you to leave the city. But what was left just wasn't that great. It was a 50-50 shot of being a problem.
Wow. So what was the process? What was your, oh my gosh, this is a great tenant application?
If they had lived in their house for, not lived in their, if they've been on their job, same job for a while, and that way if they don't pay the rent, you can probably, you know, get a deficiency judgment and try and get that from them. If they did not live in the high desert and they were moving in from some other area, that usually worked out really well, especially if they came from another state. The ones we got from other states were great tenants. But if they lived up in the high desert, they had switched jobs a lot, they'd moved a lot, those were not great tenants.
How about the credit? Is that something that you looked at? And
we did not focus a lot on credit. We made sure they didn't have any prior evictions, and we contacted the current landlord and, more importantly, the previous landlord. The current landlord will tell you anything possible to get rid of the
right.
bad tenant. The one before is the good one.
He's going to tell you everything.
We also confirmed that both landlords actually own those rental properties, so we made sure we weren't talking to like their cousin or their boyfriend or something like that.
Okay. What was the common reason people renting and not owning? Okay, the first segment, they lost their property. What about the next group? There's no way they could afford to buy, even at the discounted price?
You know, I've noticed that for me, the high desert seems like there's a permanent shift in demand. They're not interested in owning anymore up in that area. Now, down in this area might be different, but I've just noticed that the people, the age group that was aggressively pursuing houses, maybe from 25 years old to 35 years old a decade ago, that age group is just not as interested in owning anymore.
Do you think that's because the reward of aggressive price increases has just not been there, so the enticement is bland?
It could be that. It could be they saw people lose big time in real estate before. It could be they don't have confidence in their ability to maintain and fix up the property. It could be that they just don't see an exit payday on that thing. You know, they don't. They're going to buy it for $200,000, and in their mind, in 10 years from now, it'll still be worth $200,000. They're putting nothing down. Why bother? I'll just rent.
Do most people that rented from you work within 20 miles of the rental?
Most of them did. A lot of them either were truck drivers or worked up in the high desert. Some of them worked down the hill. If they worked really far away, we wouldn't rent to them. So I remember getting one application. The guy worked like El Segundo or something. I mean, it was going to be an hour and a half one-way drive, and we turned him down.
See, it's interesting because I never thought about it, but the buyer for Victorville was the Riverside occupant as a renter. Couldn't afford to buy in Riverside, and they were willing to drive that hour just to get the price tag.
They're not now. They're going to stay in Riverside and rent.
That's right. But they're not as motivated as they were. But that's interesting that the local people probably were never what pushed the market up. It was somebody migrating in.
And that is how it is now. When we sell a house, if we list it for sale up there, there's two MLS boards, one up there and one down the hill, down here where we're at. Most of our buyers come from down the hill, and we get much higher offers down the hill. And if you run the comps out of the two MLS systems, and I do, about a third of the sales only show up on the down the hill MLS, not the up the hill. Those are always the highest comps.
Okay.
And the appraisers that live up there don't use the MLS down here. So if you get an appraiser up there, you're going to come in low. You're going to have a problem.
Okay.
And we did. We have.
Interesting. What would be the typical family unit that was running from you, like a married or kids? And
you know, it was either married or a man and woman with two or three kids is what we went up a lot of times. Initially, that's who we rented to. By the end of them moving out, a lot of times it was something different. One or of the spouses either moved out or switched it up, and now there's a different person living there. There's a lot of that.
Okay.
There was, I would say, boy, about a third of them, things changed, and
their family status.
Wow. Something happened, and husband or wife is gone now, and a lot of times that's why they had to move or didn't pay their rent.
What was the typical inventory that you had targeted to buy? What was the makeup of it?
Yeah, we went after all the same stuff. So built after 78 because they didn't want to deal with the lead-based paint issues.
Right.
And mostly three-bedroom, two-bath with two-car garages and usually 1,300 to 1,500 square feet. And that's what I like to buy up there.
You have a lot of competition in that pocket for rent?
You know, for us, if the rents for those went from $9.95 to $11.95, and that seems to be what everyone can afford. And if you're at $9.95, which is usually where we were, you attract the more applicants and you can get a better selection. So it gets down to, we get the 30 calls and the 10 people that saw it, 6 applications, and that was us at $9.95 with a house that was in above average condition.
Okay. And you still had a 50-50 shot of something not being good at the end of the year.
After 2012. Well, after the end of, say, 2 years.
Okay.
But usually their family life, their job life, or something else threw a wrench in the plan within the first 2 years, half the time, and things just did not end well.
So what factor do you think dictates the type of tenant you're going to have, area or inventory?
I would say area. I would say that most people that we ran into did not necessarily want to live up there. That's just all they could afford.
Okay.
And we would have done much better and made way more money buying half as many houses in Rialto or Fontana or Ontario versus being up there. That was an error in judgment, putting all our eggs in that basket.
What percentage did you actually have to evict?
I would say 10 to 20%.
Okay.
there was some very large offers to move out before an eviction took place, cash offers, and none of them took us up on that.
Wow.
I have one going now where he rents for $695 a month. It's a duplex in Apple Valley. We sold it, and we thought he was the good tenant, so we got rid of the one in the back, and this guy never called for anything, always paid on time, never place looked great from the outside. We finally got in for the inspection and found out he had five cats in there, and the cats were indoor cats, and he did not own a litter box and did not clean up anything. So all our brand new wood floors, carpet, paint, baseboards, all destroyed.
Okay.
And so we offered him, and everyone flipped out. Agents, inspectors putting on a hazmat mask when he's going on through the house, the appraiser, everybody flipped out. This guy's paying $695 a month. I offer him a month's free rent and $2,500 cash on top of his deposit to be out by the end of July. He does not respond because he knows he's been on the internet and he knows he can probably squeeze 6 months of free rent out of that.
Out just, of the process?
Yeah, just fighting the process. And the process has gotten longer and longer, and it's easier and easier for tenants to squeeze out 6 months if they fight a good fight. It's not hard for them to fight it. I mean, that out of pocket for him would be less than $500. So
less than $100 a month. Yeah.
Yeah. And us trying to combat his multiple trips to court will probably run us $2,500. That's why I offered him $2,500. I'd be out in a month. I give you $2,500. I even threw in a mover. Told him, hey, I get you a mover. I'll pay for the moving van. I'll move your stuff and put it in storage. $2,500. You can put your five cats in one of those pet hotels while you go look for a new place. And no response. Now, and that's usually what happens now.
How often did you get called by the new landlord in a situation where you had to evict somebody?
Never.
Never?
No, I don't think ever.
Interesting.
And if I did, I'm not sure how I would handle that call. As I don't want to get sued. But I would probably find some way to let them know I would not rent to that person again.
Yeah, that would be a tough position to be in. You've rented properties prior to this era.
Yes.
So how different was the tenant this time than...
Well, I was very successful, especially in the high desert, renting from 2000 to 2006. It was great. Rents were much higher. Quality of tenants were much higher. Never did an eviction. Never had an eviction.
Wow.
It was
same area,
completely different. Yes,
boom cycle, people making money.
Must be. They wanted to live there. They wanted the house. They wanted to buy something eventually. Things were much more stable. Incomes were more stable. They kept their jobs longer, and that's what kind of enticed me to go back in 2010. I thought, you know what? I was renting these things for $1,300. They were selling for $350. They're offering them for $65,000 now. I should load up. And I did not anticipate the quality of the tenant had declined that much.
You know, we hear that magic term, positive cash flow. So what spread is actually required to end up with one?
I don't know, but I'll tell you what doesn't work. If you rent a house for $1,000 and your PITI payment is $700, that last $300 a month is not positive cash flow. That will easily get gobbled up to vacancy, maintenance, evictions, water heaters, massive rainstorms, septic tanks. I mean, that extra almost 30% a month just goes towards ongoing maintenance, repairs, and vacancy.
And very
in the high desert.
And very few rentals have that spread usually. I mean, if you're buying new, you know, if you own them free and clear, that's a different story, but
well, I can tell you after having, you know, 60 that I'm dealing with, that on a huge pool, that's what I found out to be the number. Now, there's been times where I only had five and things were going great and I was keeping that whole 300. And I thought, well, you know, when I get this other batch, it's going to be like that too. I fixed them all up before the tents moved in and everything's going to be great. And it just didn't play out that way. You will lose about a third of your rent just towards those other, if you're in a low income, blue collar area.
And that's not taxes and insurance. You're talking about miscellaneous list.
Yeah, miscellaneous.
Okay.
Now, if I'm talking taxes, insurance, and a property manager, half.
Half.
Half goes away. Yeah. So if you get $1,000 a month, you have a property manager, $500 just goes to covering expenses, insurance, taxes, and the property manager. So your mortgage payment better not be more than $500 a month. Long term, you might have a year or two where it's winning, and then year three, air conditioner goes out, and there goes $3,000.
Yeah.
And $3,000, that takes out a lot of positive cash flow.
Yeah, it does.
And that's $3,000 getting a deal. You know, and the air conditioning guy, you running the whole thing and not getting a permit, doing it on a weekend and hoping you don't need a crane to get it on the roof. If you're getting the contractor from Glendora to put it in,
$6,000.
Yeah, yeah. Six. Yeah, there goes
four years
of positive cash flow.
Okay, so now that's where you land on the, if it's not inflating pretty radically, I'm probably not too excited about having a rental property.
I'm not excited at all. However, I do have a couple rentals in good areas, and that is completely different. Those tenants never call, they pay early, they don't move, they stay for a long time. If you don't bump the rents, they'll stay forever. I just find it hard to make the numbers work on that. You know, when you're renting a, you know, you got a house that's worth $600,000 and you're renting it for $2,500 a month, you're going to have to put $200,000 down on that thing just to break even. That's a lot of money to tie up just to break even.
So let's just talk about a couple of other investments that now that you've done a lot of liquidity. So you know what trust deeds are.
I do.
So,
and I really prefer that. So I can buy, a rental in Hesperia for $200,000 cash, and I might get $1,200 a month from that. And when it's all said and done, if I have a property manager, I'm going to end up with $600 a month profit, about $7,200 bucks a year, which is less than 4% of my money. Or I can lend that $200,000 out and easily get 7 or 8%. On a 60% loan to value type deal, I can even lend it to that guy that's buying that $200,000 house up in Hesperia. I can lend him 60%, 120, and 8%. I'm getting $9,600 bucks a year, and I'm not doing anything. I'm not worrying about the house, the tenant, the eviction. I don't have to worry about the city wanting to inspect my house, or, you know, I don't have to worry about, oh, they changed the smoke detector laws, and now I have to spend $100 for new smoke detectors and $50 for some guy to go reinstall those. I had that happen with 60 houses, $150 a house is $9,000. $9,000 for smoke detectors. And I had working smoke detectors in those houses already. So I don't have to worry about any of that. I can just have that guy send the check automatically to my retirement account, and I can be anywhere in the world and the money's just there. And if he doesn't make the payments, I can send in a check for $1,000, start a foreclosure, and 5 months later, that house that he paid $200 for, I own now, and I paid $120 plus the foreclosure fees.
A lot of people get locked in to a certain percentage of their assets into real estate because they have a lot of profit. They don't want to pay tax, so they 1031 exchange and stay in something.
I did a lot of that in 2006, and that did not work out well for me.
Okay. Yeah, it was no place to hide, probably.
There was
We found Dallas and Fort Worth.
You probably did better than I did.
Well, they just never went up. They didn't go up when we went there. We were hiding. That was not like, let's go there so it goes up. It just probably wouldn't go down. So
I took two or three rentals in Barstow and walked out with, I think, $150,000 in profit. I rolled that into one house in Victorville and one house in Apple Valley. I paid $175 for each house in 2006. I got rid of the one in Apple Valley. I think I got $90,000 for a few years ago. The one in Victorville, I'm selling right now. That's the one that went in escrow today. I'm getting $146. I paid $175 for it a decade ago, and I spent $20,000 getting the tenant out, rehabbing it, fixing everything. I've got probably $8,000 in closing costs, so I'm probably losing at least $50,000-$60,000 on that one because I didn't want to pay the tax on that. $150 a decade ago. The tax would have been $40,000. I would have walked out with $110,000 after tax, but I didn't want to pay it.
Yeah. What do you do other? Do you do a fair amount of other than real estate investing?
I'm in with a few other investors that buy apartment buildings, and they'll each pony up. And these are pretty sophisticated guys, and they're usually apartment buildings that have some sort of value-added feature where maybe they can add extra units or the rents are below market because they need to be rehabbed, something like that. And we'll each put up some money and take a small sliver of ownership in that. And
but these, you guys control the
we do.
Outcome?
Yes.
Okay.
We do. And we're completely involved in that. I do that. I also like a lot of like mutual fund type investments called ETFs. In the stock market where I can get 3 to 4% dividends. I would rather have 4% dividends on maybe 50 different stocks than have that rental house and get 3 or 4% with the tenant in there. For me, having the tenant in a rental house, I have a roof that's wearing out, a water heater that's wearing out, all these other things are wearing out, and a tenant that will eventually move. And if the house isn't going up in value, it's just not for me. I would never buy that stuff out of state in like the Midwest where a house is worth 100 grand now. It'd be worth 100 grand a decade from now. It's worth 100 grand 20 years ago. It'll be worth 100,000, you know, when your kids inherit 30 years from now. I just don't want that.
I understand.
And the house is slowly rotting away on the lot. That's just not for me.
Okay. Most of the people that we know that have phenomenal net worths have that pile of real estate.
I understand.
And you and I actually have a very similar opinion. I'm not in love with rental real estate, but I do find tax-wise, I have a certain portion of what I have stuck.
Yeah, I don't know how I'm going to deal with taxes, because without rentals, I mean, that shields. You can shield like half your income with a rental portfolio, even more with a nice rental portfolio. So I haven't figured out how I'm going to deal with that yet. I might be like, hey, I'm paying all these taxes. I might have to pile up on rental houses again at some point. Hopefully not. I'm hoping I can find another piece of that puzzle.
A few quick questions just for if you have a real estate problem, who do you call?
I usually call you or Mike Cantu or Tony.
Okay.
Or I'm in a group with other investors, a Google group, and we can put a question up on that. There's probably 15 or 20 other investors, and they will come up with an answer really quick. And usually you'll get 5 or 10 answers.
Yeah. That's good to have a little network of people that's been through it.
It's amazing. I really am trying to structure my life, though, so I don't have to ask that kind of question.
Yeah, I don't blame you.
I don't want that.
I just asked Ward Hannigan a question today. So
that would be a good resource, too.
Not a bad guy.
No.
Favorite newsletter?
Mine's a stock market newsletter now. It's nothing to do with real estate.
I know. So that's all right.
I avoid real estate. I don't even look at real estate anymore. I'm so tapped out.
I know you know Malden. Do you like Malden stuff?
I like Malden. I read his stuff. And he's got a few other people that work underneath him now that send out newsletters. And I love all those other, like there's like 4 or 5 other newsletters that come out. I love all of that.
Okay.
So I read that. There's another guy that I just started reading, a blog, Jim Collins. I like his stuff. And then I'm really obsessed with these people. And it's amazing lifestyle where they've just sold everything. And they live in RVs now, and they just travel around the country, and they just have adventures, and just, wow, I like that. I mean, they're just living like that.
We're going to see a Rick Solis vlog. Where's Rick?
Maybe. I'll be eating lobster in Maine. I've heard the lobster in Maine is so cheap, like, you get tired of it. It's like $4, and you're having a lobster lunch. So I'd be something like that. Although I will keep a house, too, but I want to live that lifestyle for a little while.
All right.
Not forever.
Favorite motivational trainer?
Zig Ziglar, by far.
Really?
I love that crazy accent he's got. For me, that's the guy. That is the guy that actually got me going when I was having hard times as a teenager. Started listening to his stuff, reading his stuff. I actually had his cassette tapes. Loved it.
I actually spoke to him one day because I'd listened to his stuff, and I don't know, me and another guy, let's just call and we can talk to him at home.
I love that. Cool. I would like to know if his accent was legit or if that
was
just
pretty legit. It sounded just like him, actually.
Wazoo, Michigan or something.
You know, one of my favorite stories is that he got kicked out of that. Remember that private club he wasn't a part of? And he was in a pool and got kicked out because he wasn't a member. And in his residence, he built a pool that was 1 foot longer than the pool at the club with an arrow.
I did not know that.
So the tip of the arrow was the foot that he got. Real estate training.
You know, the only stuff I take now is yours, especially the market timing stuff. That's the only stuff I do. Otherwise, I don't pay attention to real estate at all. I don't even go to the club meetings anymore. I'm done. But I'd known that a couple good books and your timing stuff is really all you need. And
what's the books?
You know, I like, there's John Schaub. Yeah. His books are amazing.
Yep.
And then there's two other guys, Jimmy Napier they're all in Florida. And there's four guys. And I think that Jack Miller was the third guy. So between those three,
They were like a pack.
Yeah, it was good stuff. John Schaub's really good.
He is. Rick, we've run out of time. Thanks for joining us, and I really appreciate it. You've been a great asset to the industry. I hope you're not gone long.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to the Norris Group Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com.